and welcome back to a brand new series of the Ice World podcast. I'm marine biologist Nadia Frontier, here with more conversations recorded with scientists and support staff from the British Antarctic Survey. Today, we're opening season four with two pilots, Vicky Auld and Ollie Smith, who were in Canada when we spoke recently and just days away from beginning their ferry flights down to the frozen continent of Antarctica. They'll be flying unpressurized Twin Otter and Dash aircraft all the way, making multiple stops and crossing the spine of the Andean Mountains en route to Rotherhithe Research Station. On arrival, they will be the first people to break the winter bubble for everyone there, and not only will the new faces be welcome, but hopefully they'll also be bringing some supplies of freshies, that is, fresh fruit and vegetables. The theme of this podcast season is summer science in Antarctica, so we're kicking it off with talking about the logistics as a first major hurdle, that is, getting scientists and equipment onto the White Continent. Vicky and Ollie joined me online for a chat, and the first thing I needed to know was there an amazing Canadian light view from their windows? Was it as good as Antarctica?
I'm currently in North Bay, which is about a four-hour drive north of Toronto, and it's where we keep the Dash 7 aircraft, and it goes through a deep maintenance here. So when I'm looking out the window from the hotel in North Bay, it's quite a small town, and it's a beautiful late summer Canadian day. And I can see the trees are just turning. If you imagine the kind of Canadian maple trees, and there's a beautiful red colour that you just don't get in UK trees, or maybe you do, but it's been so long since I've spent a fall and an autumn in the UK. But they're looking fabulous on the hill outside the hotel room.
Oh, that sounds so nice. And also crazy to think that you spent so many Antarctic summers without spending any UK autumns for so long. We'll get on to that. Ollie, what have you been up to this week in Canada?
Just been getting the Twin Otters ready to go. So on Tuesday, we got three of our Twin Otters leaving Calgary. So we've just been flying the aircraft, making sure they're happy for their big journey down south, and getting all the permits ready, all the stuff ready, or getting all loaded, everything. So it's just admin and a little bit of flying around in the beautiful Rocky Mountains.
How long have you been there for, Ollie?
So I've been in Canada for just over 2 weeks now, but was with me and Vicky were in Toronto doing some training for the first week. And then the second week I've been here in Calgary. So just under a week.
When are you due to start your ferry flight?
So Tuesday. So in a couple of days' time. So we've got a day off today, and then another day of prep the day after, and then we get going on the Tuesday.
Vicky, when do you start your transit south on the Dash?
We follow a day later than Ollie and the Twin Otters. So we should be going on Wednesday, but we still have just one more post-maintenance flight to complete on the Tuesday morning.
Wow, such a process. Amazing. Ollie, when did you first set foot into an aircraft?
Yeah, so I'm Ollie Smith. I'm the head of aircraft training at BAS. I'm not exactly sure when I first set foot in an aircraft. I kind of been hanging around and flying airplanes, I think, since I was about 14. Mostly annoying people and hoping I can blag rides in airplanes, a little bit of the air cadets. And so that's kind of how I started. Just, I think that's how I got most of my jobs, just being loitering around until eventually they give me the job. Did a little bit of my flying training with some scholarships through the air cadets, and then a little bit with the university air squadron. And then after that, I did all my civilian flying training, and then I joined an aircraft museum, and then I flew all airplanes for about 3 years. And then after that, I worked for Aussie Skybus that fly the Twin Otter. So I flew for them for 4 years, doing 10-minute flights from Land's End to Aurzazili. So we used to do quite a lot of flights. So that's kind of basically my background before I came to BAS, before I annoyed the chief pilot enough to make him give me a job.
How long did you have to annoy the chief pilot for at the British Antarctic Survey?
It was 6 years before he gave me a job.
Wow! Impressive dedication. Kudos to you.
It's also quite, the BAS requirements for pilots are quite high, so you have to kind of meet a lot of goalposts, and there's a lot of mentoring of people, so it took a bit of time for me to get the actual qualifications I needed.
Yeah, I mean, it is a super high risky job, I guess, and probably even already being a pilot is super high risk. I can imagine being in Antarctica just adds another layer to it. Vicky, how long have you been working with the British Antarctic Survey, and what motivated you to become a pilot?
Oh, gosh, I started in with the survey in 1996, so straight out of uni. I started as a meteorologist originally, though, so the flying came much later. So initially I was a scientist at Halley, doing a couple of winters at Halley, and then I left BASC for a couple of years, came back as a station leader, and during those years, particularly the ones at Halley, I got the opportunity to sit in the Twin Otter in the co-pilot seat because we fly them as a single pilot operation. And I'd never been on a small plane before, and it was just quite overwhelming, very, very exciting. Never occurred to me at the beginning that I could ever, you know, actually be a pilot with them. But over time, and with some encouragement from the pilots that were working there at the time, they said, if you really want to be a pilot, why don't you just go and do the training, see how you get on. So I did. So I did, like Ollie, it's about 15 months of training to actually get your commercial license. And then I went to fly with Flybe, which is a large turboprop, larger than any of the aircraft we actually fly with BASS. And during that time, I was also in touch with the chief pilot going, have I got enough hours yet? Can I apply yet? So in that respect, quite a similar story to Ollie, just before we both managed to get the job that we had wanted for some time.
What a transformation. What year did you become a pilot with British Antarctic Survey, Vicky?
I started in 2013.
Yeah. Amazing. So over 10 years now.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ollie, what's it like for you flying over the Antarctic land and skyscape? Can you remember what your first flight was like?
I don't think there's anything else I'd really want to do in terms of flying. I think it's a really hard thing to describe. It's just super varied. My favourite is the mountains in around Rothera, down towards Fossil Bluff on the top end of Alexander Island. It's super mountainous. You get mountains from the sea all the way up to 10,000 feet within a couple of miles. So you get these really jaggedy, spiky mountains, mountain waves, and just the weather. I don't know, there's so much variety of it. And then when you go away from that, the mountains, you've got the big flat unending like polar plateau, which has its own challenges and its own beauty. And so there's just the variety of the landscape is what I like the most. And then my first flight, I had quite an unusual first flight because most people have a couple of training flights before they go off, whereas my training captain, we decided just to go to Fossil Bluff. So my very first ski landing ever was at Fossil Bluff, which is a depot and a little cottage at the end of the world, where two people are there. So my first landing was at Fossil Bluff, and my mum and dad still have that picture of me in their kitchen, actually.
Wow. So you had to land the plane yourself?
Yeah, with under the supervision of the training captain. So it's one of those things where you're kind of, it was a beautiful day and the challenges are quite, it's quite easier on the good days. But the thing I still remember vividly is I remember always thinking, it's going to be this nice, smooth, beautiful landing. It's going to be on snow. It's going to be really lovely and gentle. And then it's not. It's like landing on the roughest strips you've been ever. It's really, really quite rough. And I still remember being quite shocked by that as we touched down.
Vicky, can you explain to us what a ferry flight means? So we've talked about that. That's where you'll be leaving Canada and coming down to Antarctica. So like, what's that process and how long does it take you?
Yeah, the different aircraft fly at different speeds. So I'm coming in the Dash and it'll just be a full 6 days flying. Quite comfortable compared to the Twin Otter because it has tea making facilities and a toilet on board. Whereas the Twin Otter takes, I think it's taking 10 days this year with 1 day off in the middle. We're basically flying down the Americas with several fuel stops and overnight stops. The Dash is basically full of cargo, and the Twin Otter has some extra fuel tanks put in because some of these flights are quite long for a Twin Otter, so they don't have much room for cargo. Most of that, the space in the cabin is taken up with extra fuel. And the idea is then to get down to Punta Arenas in Chile, southern point of Chile, both aircraft around the same time, and then the Twin Otters will go in and hopefully start up the season for us.
Ollie, how do you feel about not having a toilet during 10 days of flying?
We do kind of have a very basic toilet in there. So we have a funnel, and we have a bucket that we put bin liners in, which is the glamorous. So I guess it's just one of those things that you get used to.
Yeah, very different to obviously commercial aircraft that almost everyone has experienced. Vicky, can you describe the unpredictability of Antarctic logistics? What is the longest time that you've had to wait with super eager passengers ready to get to Antarctica for the first time in Punta Arenas or the Falkland Islands? These are the gateways, as you talked about, getting to Antarctica.
Gosh, the longest time. I think the longest time for me personally, the unexpected longest time was probably 4 or 5 days while we're waiting for a part in Punta Arenas so that a part can get replaced on the aircraft and might have to travel down from Canada and then get fitted before we're able to continue the air bridges from Punta into Rotherua. But I think for the passengers, it's quite a different thing. You know, I think as pilots, we're used to living with that kind of uncertain timescale and changing logistics. Whereas for passengers, I can think of a couple of instances, particularly over COVID, when they'd been in quarantine for 2 weeks. And then the runway, I think, was icy. So there was an extra 2 week delay on top of that. Well, some work was done on the runway. And then if you're unlucky and there's not quite enough payload, you know, we need to balance passenger weights against the fuel we need. So sometimes we have to bump a passenger off. So if you're unlucky, I think there was someone that was waiting 5 weeks to get into Antarctica one season. And, you know, if that person happens to be a PhD student and they're trying to get the data the only time they can, it can have a massive impact on them.
I could just imagine. Yeah, it is quite a frustrating situation. Ollie, how do you manage the ferrying of people and yourself to and from the gateway locations in Antarctica? Like, who makes the schedule of choosing which pilots will fly and when?
We have more pilots than we have the aeroplane seats, effectively. So we've got 2 seats on the dash, and then we've got a single seat on each of the twin otters. So it's generally the chief pilot who does the juggling act of who's going to go in early, who's going to go in late. I'm in a different situation where I'm usually training the new pilots. So it's pretty common for me to go in first wave with another pilot. So for example, this ferry flight, I'm going in with a new pilot who we're training up. And then, so that's kind of almost as set in stone as anything is. And then the rest is kind of subject to how much work you've done in the summer, how long a season you had last year, how long you're going to be running in. So that's all a big juggling act as always. The stuff in the season is a little bit different. So in the season, you have a designated pilot in charge. You sometimes the chief pilot, sometimes it's either me or Vicky in that role. And then it's really based upon people's experience more than anything else. We have various different qualifications, so not everybody can land at all the different sites. We have different people with different skill sets in terms of operating really deep field. So that and then also juggling days off and juggling fatigue those are the main core things of the field. We generally always fly with an aircraft engineer as well, who keeps the lights on and keeps the aircraft fixed and also looks after the cabin as well, supervises the cabin, makes sure all the passengers are kind of happy and safe and has some responsibilities if there was an emergency in the cabin. So it's a kind of 2-pilot but a 3-person crew on the Dash 7, and that's, you know, that's pretty much always like that.
Oh, I love it when the pilots come in. I think it's just super exciting. I think, I'm not going to lie, I probably am more excited for the influx of fresh fruit and veg, but it's also so nice to see new faces and also to just have that ramp up of loads going on. So I really enjoy that. What is it like when you're the first aircraft to land and the winter is ready to accept you? Do you feel like you've burst their bubble? How is it?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I can remember that feeling at Halley when the aircraft arrived and kind of broke the winter, so to speak. And I'm aware you've had that feeling a few times now, Nadia, after your wintering. But the freshies is the big one, isn't it? It's just like how much freshies is, and what are they when they arrive on the aircraft for that first time? And then obviously in recent years, there's quite a lot of cargo and people trying to get down on those first few flights. So freshies seems to take a little bit of a back seat. So knowing how important it is, I think we do try our very hardest to get as much down as we can.
It totally does, Vicky. I mean, I think I remember maybe 2 years ago that there was like the first few flights, there was no tomatoes and no cucumbers. And I was like, what are the pilots doing? But it's good that you've obviously explained that there are clearly other priorities. But so Vicky, you'll be arriving a day after the first twin otter lands on the runway in a 16 passenger seated aircraft called the Dash 7, as we've mentioned. So who are the priority passengers that you bring down to kickstart the opening up of the summer science season?
So the first crew will be obviously the 2 pilots and the engineer. And then I think this year we have the forecaster so that they can have the full kit available to them, and to be able to give us some incredibly accurate forecasts these days. And also that that kind of supports the people that are actually doing the weather observations at Rothera itself in that kind of final hour when the dash is what we call PSR. So it's just beyond a point of safe return and it doesn't really have any other options apart from to land at Rothera. Speaking to the forecaster who's on site at that point is really valuable to the pilots to help make their decision whether it's safe to continue or not. And then we also bring in this year Zoe, who's our ground support coordinator. So basically is responsible for overseeing all the refueling of aircraft, opening up of all the containers around the hangar, moving the aircraft in and out of the hangar, making sure that the apron surface is suitable for that. And then we also have a tower supervisor and a field ops manager that come in on that first flight, because you'll remember we have lots of transiting aircraft that are using Rothera as a stop off before they go into deeper Antarctica to work with other countries' operations in the Antarctic. So this is, you know, it's just a cool part of the job. And the first flight is always the most challenging when you haven't actually been in and seen for yourself what the runway situation is like, for instance. But after that, the next people on that next flight are as crucial to the whole operation as those initial people, because we're bringing in all the support staff, so catering, cleaning staff, that just mean that the station can actually accommodate all the extra staff that will be coming in over the summer.
Ollie, do you prefer being on station or do you prefer flying in the field?
Yeah, I really like flying in the field. My first, before I did the training role, my first six season, I just used to be kind of a deep field specialist. I used to go off on big projects. My biggest one was 11 weeks living in the airplane. I really like that. I really like going out with a huge list of jobs and just kind of getting on with it and living in the airplane. And to a certain extent, you are kind of your own boss. You have your own airplane. And that's where all the really interesting stuff happens in my eyes.
Okay, yeah, so let's move on to that then. Let's start talking about the science. So what other roles do you take when you're not being a pilot shuttling people between South America or the Falkland Islands and Rothera?
So when we're in the field, we kind of take on the role of looking after people, so that our passengers, once we landed, we kind of have to look after them in terms of their welfare. There's a huge amount of digging. That's the joke in Bath, that there's always digging to do. So digging up science instruments that have been buried, digging up fuel that's been buried, fueling the aircraft, trying to get some rest when you can. And then when you do have days off in the field, helping out with the science, you know, there's some of the really big ambitious projects are always got, they've always got unskilled labour that they need a pilot to help out with every so often. So yeah, there's always things to do in the field.
So when you've got a bit of light dust and of snow in the UK, it's just an absolute no problem for you at all to dig out or clear your doorway compared to the meters and meters you could be digging down into like glaciated environments, for example, to access instrumentation or install a piece of equipment.
Yeah, the instruments are the worst ones because you have to be a bit more delicate with the drums. You can dig down, and when you get to them, you can throw your shovel around them. Whereas the instruments, once you get down to them, there's often really, really precious cables that you can't break, and because they're black, they're usually covered in ice, so you're chipping around them. They're the biggest ones for me. Some of the ones that we used to have some seismometers out on Pine Island Way, where it would be 3 or 4 meters digging down to them, and then when you got down to them, they were covered in ice, and then you had to get them out. So they weighed almost 300 kilos, the instrument, and so you had to try and lift them out of this giant pit that you've made.
Wow, and there's no heavy machinery to help lift them out, is there?
No, you've got to
do it yourself.
You've got to be kind of pragmatic and sensible about it. Generally, the field guide, if you have them, will do some clever rope work if it's that bad. But other than that, you just got to be sensible and try and use human bodies to get it out.
Vicky, what's the furthest south that you've flown as part of a science project?
Approximately 85 south. I'm saying approximately, but wow. I mean, Ollie has flown to the pole in the times that we were actually going and servicing instruments from the pole. I wasn't that lucky, but I did get a couple of times to 85 south, and the things that we're doing at those kind of deep field locations, I was coming in to support a survey crew. So we had set up some radars on one of the aircraft and we're doing some ice studies from the aircraft above the ice, flying above the ice several hours a day. And they needed a resupply. So it was just a quick overnight trip to them. Other times we're flying to instruments that may not have been visited for a couple of years. So you have no idea what surfaces you'll find when you get there. As Ollie says, it usually involves some physical activity once you're on the ground.
And are you also battling really cold temperatures if you're so far south, basically the South Pole, and also at altitude? What kind of temperatures are you getting?
Yeah, much colder than Rothera, where in the summer it is kind of hovering around zero for quite a lot of the middle of the summer. But we're typically operating at our kind of main fuel station of Sky Blue is about minus 10 to 20, and then some of these deeper field and higher altitude sites are probably minus 30, but not that much more than that necessarily. Has your experience different?
No, I think that's a great, there's outliers sometimes where, depends on the terms of the years, where you can get below the 40s, but yeah, I think minus 30 is about usual.
Okay, that's, yeah, I suppose in winter it's an absolutely different story where you're having minus 80, a lot warmer when you're actually flying in that summer period using the light. Ollie, so you've been to the South Pole. I didn't know that fact about you. Did you plant a flag? What was that like?
I didn't plant a flag. I probably should have put some Cornish flag on the thing, but I think that would have gone down pretty badly.
Such a Cornish thing to say.
You do all the pictures and stuff like that. It's always the thing that as well is funny is that the pictures that you see of people at the pole with all the flags and the shiny barber's pole, that's not really the South Pole. They call that the ceremonial South Pole. That's a pretend point. Because the station's on a moving plateau, the station actually is moving away from the South Pole, and you actually have to go into the industrial part of the station where the generators are, where there's a very, very small marker which actually marks the real South Pole. From our perspective, it's really interesting. The navigational challenge for us going to the South Pole is quite interesting. The way that you navigate the aircraft is quite different. If you make a mistake, you can get really caught out. So there's lots of challenges and you'll be quite careful about use of oxygen and stuff. So it's from a pilot perspective, it's really interesting.
So without being too technical, but is there more magnetic interference at the pole that's causing, like you're saying, if you make a mistake around that 90 degrees south, is that causing more issues than it would, like, say, if you're flying on the peninsula?
It's not through the magnetic interference. Weirdly, people will find it hard to believe, but actually, because the magnetic South Pole is so far from the geographic South Pole, your instruments can align properly. However, the problem is, people are probably quite familiar with the concept of magnetic variation, and you get variations up to 180 degrees. So it's very easy to get quite confused about which way is the correct way to go. It's quite easy to get airborne and go the wrong way and only realize about 20 miles after you get airborne that you've gone the wrong way. So we use the sun. The sun is quite a good compass. So we use the sun as a bit of a check and balance to make sure you haven't taken off and turned the wrong way.
That is absolutely fascinating. I love that fact. Vicky, what do you like working with a variety of different science projects and such a myriad of people? What kind of challenges do you encounter?
The challenges aren't, I mean, sometimes they are the people, but I think for me, the longer I've been in the job, I think for me, it's also a mental challenge of kind of balancing the value of the science that we're trying to do against the impact that we're making in terms of the fuel use. So for me, it's really good to see that kind of recently science projects are now being evaluated before we even get down south as to their importance, I guess, versus the amount of fuel and emissions that science might require.
That is such a good point to make. I think really we can't talk about being pilots in Antarctica and the impact of flying without acknowledging the amount of fuel it takes. And also, especially with the rise of automation of certain science projects, there is definitely that push towards seeing if we can do science more effectively without having to do so much work on the ground, which provides amazing data, and we still need that to an extent. But absolutely, the impact associated with it is huge. Ollie, have you got a particularly memorable science project or field experience that you participated in?
one of the things that Bass does really, really well is, in my opinion, is hot water drilling. I think we're one of the world leaders on that. And they drilled this giant, massive hole, and they put this, they got this little remote submarine, and they put it underneath it, and they managed to video the underwater sort of the grounding zone of the ice shelf, the Thwaites ice shelf, which is making a lot of news at the minute. So that was really interesting from a pilot perspective. That was a lot of movements. You know, as soon as you think of drilling equipment and submarines, you're looking at rotations of aircraft in, you know, almost in the three figures. You know, we moved almost 400,000 pounds of cargo from a site to there. So it was three aircraft, but that was pretty hard work. But it was really rewarding at the end of it to see this amazing footage and this really world-leading science that came out of that, which is still having a big impact at the minute.
Absolutely. And so exciting and so cool that you were involved in that. In addition to working closely with other pilots and operational support from Cambridge in the air unit and engaging with science projects, Vicky also talked about how you work closely and bring in the forecasters, radio operators, field operations managers, so many other station personnel. How do you manage this interaction with a variety of different jobs, and what's it like?
I really like that. It's my favorite bit of the job, actually, is the interaction with other people. It's the people are what make life exciting and interesting, and people are all got their own experiences. The forecasters are really interesting people. The field ops managers have got a really different take on the world, and they're very focused on their goal. And then the people on the station, people come in, and the really beautiful thing, as Vicky said earlier, we get the opportunity to fly with co-pilots. We're not allowed to be on our own. So you get to take somebody out in an airplane that may have never flown in a light aircraft before, over just down to Fossil Bluff, which is one of the most beautiful flights in the world. And it's a real pleasure, and it's a really magical experience, to be honest.
I absolutely agree. It's one of the highlights of our job, I think. And it's definitely the kind of time that stands out for me. And I think it really invigorates me as well. What reinvigorates me when I fly with a co-pilot is the first time they may have seen all the beautiful scenery that we've been describing, and you can see them buzzing from it. And I think we probably feed off that a little bit.
Yeah. So, yeah, different conversation to spark your day, different inspiration.
It is. Flight does specifically stand out for me, and that was when I was flying to Halle, which is quite a big trip from Rotherham. There were four of us on board, and we were all girls. It was my first time with all a female kind of crew. So there was me as a pilot, Jen as an aircraft engineer, Julie as a field guide, so basically a mountain guide, and Katie, who was the scientist that was going out to find meteorites. So that was a very special flight for me.
Oh, love that. That's so good. Well, it's been so great to speak to both of you. And thank you so much for giving us such an insight into what it's like to be a pilot in Antarctica. And I really wish you the best of success for making this super long journey down North and South America to Antarctica in just a week's time, really, from where we're recording today on the 29th of September. It's probably as live as we can be on this podcast.
Thanks for inviting us on, lads.
Such a fascinating and challenging role, and amazing to hear them both talk about something they really love doing. Right now, Vicky and Ollie should be well on their way south, crossing the Americas. Safe travels to you both, and please don't forget the tomatoes or the cucumbers. There are many roles available posted in the job section of the British Antarctic Survey's website. Though, as you've heard from Ollie, and if you're just starting out as a pilot, it might take a little while before you're flying halfway round the world to Rotherham and across the white Antarctic continent. However, there are plenty of other roles which could get you there sooner than you think, such as engineering, administrative, catering and more. So do take a look if you're thinking of a new challenge and a new lifestyle. You'll love it. And if you enjoy the Ice World podcast, please tell people and think about writing a nice review. It does help us spread the word. And with a new season, I'll be saying this again. Thank you very much. I'm Nadia Frontier.